1947, NASA launched the last of America's deep space probes. Aboard this compact starship, a lone astronaut, Captain William Buck Rogers, was to experience cosmic forces beyond all comprehension. In a freak mishap, his life support systems were frozen by temperatures beyond imagination. Ranger 3 was blown out of its planned trajectory into an orbit 1,000 times more vast, an orbit which was to return Buck Rogers to Earth 500 years later.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's going on?
Just sitting here, getting ready to talk about some old stuff.
Oh. What number are we on?
3,000. 3,000.
Oh, just like Justice League 3,000.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we jumped forward in number because I'm actually...
going to read new stuff.
Well, new to the 2014, but it's really old for us in the year 3000. And I'm actually I used to be a man named Joseph. I can't even remember my last name because my identity has been printed over with that of Chris Ivey from the
Retrocast.
21st century, yeah. I'm confusing myself. No, this is episode 33. And we're going to have a guest with us that I can add in here.
I am ready. 101001.
Oh, no. We got all kinds of interference from other beings. I've been... operated on by Cadmus Labs, and you're being controlled by OMAC.
That's right.
So, hello, Norbert.
Hello.
Welcome to the Retrocast.
Thanks.
I hope you can go back 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Or more.
10 years. 10 years.
2004.
2004.
Or earlier.
Anything important happened in 2004?
Probably.
I read so few comics in 2004, 2005, and all that. I remember buying some, but didn't read a lot that year.
Yeah, I don't think I was reading a lot. Well, I'm trying to remember. Actually, I think 2006, 7, and 8 were kind of a lull for me.
What's the matter with you?
I had some other stuff going on.
Comics should never go on the back burner.
When was the last time you had a lull, Mike?
I didn't have one.
I thought when you were in college, it was kind of...
No, never. The only time is when I was saving for my house.
Okay, maybe that's what I was...
But I went and retroactively fixed that.
Yeah, you bought what you missed.
Hell yes.
But, so... Those listeners who listen to regular Geek Brunch episode 200 will recognize our guest's voice. Norbert, you were also a fan of the Buck Rogers show that we've been covering, right?
That's right. That's right. I like that a lot.
Now, did you watch it back in the day when it was coming on?
No, not strictly back in the day. I'm not sure whether I said it last time, but I remember I saw it in 1989. So by that time I was 10 years old,
mm-hmm.
And I saw that movie, you know, the pilot movie that they read it as a two episodes, or the two episodes that became the movie. That was on television at some point in the mid 80s here.
Okay.
And then 89, one of the channels showed it in like a Sunday afternoon time slot. Yeah, and I really liked the show at the time. You know, I think I saw most of the episodes in 89, 90, and sort of rediscovered it on the internet, you know, much later. And then 2 years back, you know, I bought them on DVD.
Okay. Was it dubbed in a German when they televised it?
On television, yeah, always is. And now on DVD, I can switch, you know, between the two languages. And I just checked with that episode we were going to talk about today. And when you watch that with the German dub, you know, Gary Coleman is voiced by a girl. A girl actress doing the voice.
Interesting.
He was done that in our version too, so.
I guess you either have to find a child actress or, because I know a lot of times in like animation, sometimes they'll have adult female actresses will do the voices of little boys in like cartoons and stuff.
Simpson and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
You do Bart Simpson that way.
Oh, right, yeah. That's probably what I was, one of the first things I was thinking of. Well, I'm getting an early visit from my dog.
Ah.
Usually she waits for the door to be closed for a little while before knocking it open.
I bought a toy dog recently. It was that last con I went to in late April, and I had some time to walk through that town, and they had one of those old market booths next to a church somewhere in that town. It was like a nice little old lady selling like trinkets, you know, and like these small tourist items, you know, and memorabilia. And yeah, she had some you know, fluffy toys there, and just so happened that they had like this fluffy plush toy of a husky, very small. It's about 10, 11 inches long. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was cute.
And you thought, oh, if I'm going to go on the RetroCrest, I need to have a dog.
When you said toy dog, I thought you meant like a live small dog.
I thought maybe it was a robot.
Dogs, a robot. An OMAC. An OMAC dog.
An OMAC dog, yeah.
10010.
That's how it barks.
Yeah, that's how it barks. So we're going to talk about the Cosmic Whiz Kid.
Yes.
Premiered in November 15th, 1979.
Yes, and this had, besides Gary Coleman, which we mentioned, it had quite a few recognizable faces, I thought.
Yeah, Ray Walston, Mr. Hand. Whoa. Do you know Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Yeah.
That was Mr. Hand.
Which one was that? I meant to look these up.
Roderick Zale.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The teacher where Spicoli.
Right.
Class and he ordered a pizza.
He's been in a lot of stuff. I was trying to think of where. I knew I recognized him, but I was trying to think of which, because he's.
Martian.
My favorite Martian, yeah.
He's been in a lot of stuff, but. The thing that I know him from most is Fast Times at Ridgemont High, because that's one of my favorite movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was trying to think of his henchman who was in charge of guarding.
Oh, that guy was in everything. That guy was in like one episode of Sanford and Son, one episode of Incredible Hulk, one episode of Police Woman. Every show that I watched, he was in one episode.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Are you talking about the guy that, he had a couple henchmen.
The guy that was, like, his, kind of his main right-hand guy that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, in charge of guarding Gary Coleman and.
Yeah, that guy is the one I'm talking about. I wasn't sure if you were talking about that feminine strong man.
Yeah, and he also was an actor that I recognized.
Yeah.
I
didn't look him up, though.
I think the first one we're talking about, I think, is Albert Popwell.
Mm-hmm.
He was, I know I rec. he was in the Dirty Harry films.
Yeah.
Which I recognized, and
Silver Spoons, which means
some other
Darren Gray again.
Yeah. But yeah, like you say, he did a lot of TV work on this, like, late 70s and 80s. And other appearances. And then the guy that you're talking about that was like the strong man.
Yeah, the guy that was kind of like Superman because he was born on a world where the gravity was really strong.
Yeah,
he had like powers. He could like bend stuff and jump far and all that stuff.
Yeah, and he says at one point, you know, that he's pretty much a weakling on his own planet, so that's why he left there and has no interest in going back to where he's from. So, so the basic setup is, Gary Coleman plays Hieronymus Fox, who is, he's almost 500 years old. He's 493 years old, and he's the president of a planet called Genesia. He's actually originally from the same time period as Buck Rogers from the 20th century. Before there was like a nuclear holocaust, and before that he had frozen himself. And then Genesia thawed him out and made him their leader. Because he is able to use, like, he has advanced scientific knowledge and engineering abilities and stuff. So he's happily helped them advance their colony and make it more successful.
He works for cheeseburgers.
Yeah.
And malts.
Yeah, we find out he definitely has a like a 20th century kid appetite. So that's kind of like the beginning, like the background of it, and right at the beginning of the episode, he's with his lieutenant, a woman named Lieutenant Dia Certain, played by Melody Rogers, and she has a similar fashion sense to most of the women that are on the Rogers show.
I would love to be the costume designer. You're going to wear this. It's very sci-fi.
Yeah, in the 25th century, all the diplomats and the lieutenants and whatnot, they get to wear these midriff-free clothing.
Yeah. They like to cut spots out and cut
show a lot of thighs
and stuff like that. And,
yeah, I like it. It's a good time to be in the 25th century.
But she's supposed to protect him, but he's kidnapped by Roderick Zale's people. They want to hold him for ransom, and they take him to another planet. But and this is all happening in the beginning of the episode. So she goes to Earth to Dr. Hewer and Wilma, and is pleading for their help. But they're not able to help her, and we find out that they actually can't overtly help her because they already have a plan to go behind the scenes and rescue the president, but they can't. So she leaves thinking that they're not going to do anything, and runs into Buck Rogers and flirts with him a bit.
Buck was going on vacation.
Yeah, so he's ready to go on vacation.
I think he mentioned the girl that was on a previous episode. Like, he was going to go meet so-and-so. I can't remember her name. But I think that girl has been in a previous episode, so he was going to go meet her on the vacation. And she basically gives him a drug that will...
It's just that needle, that syringe.
Yeah.
gives him like a serum to make him follow her. And he's like saying, well, as soon as I snap out of this, I'm just going to go back on vacation.
Yeah, and I liked, I made a note that when he's getting ready, he's packing his bags in his room and stuff, and there's this computer terminal type thing that's playing this weird space 25th century music, and he walks over to it like you're killing me here. Play something from my century. And
Shambhala from Three Dog Night.
So yeah, he's like, any name checks, he's like, all right, this is more like it. Three Dog Night.
So not only is Shambhala in the tunes from the TV show Lost, it's also in Buck Rogers. How about that?
Oh, I didn't even think of that connection. I've wiped my memories of Lost.
It's Lost to you?
Yeah, Lost is Lost to me.
Remember when they found that Jeep and they were driving in it and they were playing that song, Shambhala?
No.
It stuck out of my head because I'm a Three Dog Night fan, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it just wasn't as amusing as this use here. Because I like when Buck is like into some music or something, he's gets that little like white guy groove in his step.
Yeah, and it's like a not very, it's not a cool vibe. he starts moving and it's like, man, that guy has no rhythm.
Yeah. Totally. And for some reason, Twiggy gives Dr. Hewer a rubber plant. He comes in with it, carrying it. I can't remember why, if there was any reason that he did that. But he has a gift for Wilma and Dr. Hewer, and it's a rubber plant.
Yeah, Wilma uses the saying, piece of cake, and he's like, God, I wish I knew what they were talking about.
Yeah, they love doing that in the show.
Yeah.
Putting those anachronisms and that Buck brought and like Wilma's learning from him. But, so I figured you probably were thinking of me, Mike, when they get, so they take Hieronymus to this other planet where they're going to keep him captive and stuff. And at first they threaten to kill him, but he's too smart for that. He's, you know, says, there's no way you're going to kill me. He just logically knows that he's too valuable to them alive. So he starts using his leverage to demand that, that they send for, you know, cheeseburgers and milkshakes and things like that, the food that he wants.
Yeah.
But it wasn't
grass.
Right. what they wanted them to eat at first were like food discs and soy products. So I was like, oh, here it comes.
And Mike's then he gives you the recipe, right? Sorry.
No, what'd you say?
He's got the recipe down and then he gives them the instructions.
Yeah. And they're kind of grossed out by his eating.
Uh-huh. They have to use some kind of like rock lizard or something like that to make
it. Because they don't have cows.
Yeah.
No cows, yeah.
They probably have to milk it first for his milkshake, too.
Yeah. So they're a little baffled by it, but...
It's kind of funny, though, because Gary Coleman played himself. Like, even though he was in this world talking sophisticated, it still was like watching an episode of Different Strokes.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't say, what you talking about, Willis?
Yeah. He was a good choice whether it was the acting or just, you know, the casting. I did feel like he pulled off
the sense
that he was smarter, that he was smarter than a kid that age should be.
I agree. He pulled it off that he was an old guy in a young body.
Mm-hmm. At least as far as his, you know, knowledge, like his technical knowledge and stuff like that, so.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, meanwhile,
he had some good wit too. Like mm-hmm. He was very witty.
Yeah. So while this is going on, Wilma arrives on, the planet where they're holding him captive, and her cover is to have this job that's going to allow her access to technology that she needs to locate him. And I love that her boss is this total smartass robot that's totally prejudiced against human beings.
Yeah, true. I noticed that as well.
Yeah.
He hates humans.
Completely. He's just a real jerk.
Yeah, so the robot is the boss of that department, and they really made him like the stereotypical evil boss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's just putting down humans any chance that he can get.
So and her job is like monitoring the sewage system under that city.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it wasn't really clear to me at first how she was going to use that position, but she seems to strategically be placing herself there to be able to use their technology later on after hours. But while they're doing that, Buck and Dia, they go to this sort of nightclub bar sort of thing. They're looking for a guy, and he turns out to be a telepath. So they, you know, he never throughout the episode even opens his mouth. He just, and he's not like, sometimes you have telepaths in comics who are, you know, they'll make a point of not reading people's mind without their permission and stuff like that. Not this guy. he just finds out everything that they're going to say before they say it. And he's pretty proud of himself. But they think that he might know something about the location of Gary Coleman, of Hieronymus. And but he says he doesn't have any information for him.
Well, I think he says he has to be in the proximity of so many yards or something like that.
Yeah, his telepathy only works if he's near, within a certain amount of distance from the people he wants to read their mind. And he hasn't been near anybody that he picked up any information on them or anything. But thankfully, Hieronymus is pretty resourceful on his own. He's left with a guard who's pretty much mute, just kind of sitting on the bed watching TV, I think. And he's listening to headphones and just kind of jamming out. But he ends up, so after some food's delivered, he ends up pretending that there's something wrong with the headphones, and he put the headphones on the guard and asks him to test it out, see if it's just him or if they're not working right. And
you know, the headphones are huge.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird how they project how computers and stuff will look in the 25th century, because it's almost like in the TV show, the bigger the things were, the more powerful they were, and instead of what it really is, it's like the smaller.
Yeah. Although I guess in this case, you could say that instead of they just had a preference for Beats headphones over iPhone earbuds.
Yeah. Big old headphones. Oh, noise canceling headphones, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was predicting that Dr. Dre would sell Beats to Apple. It's prophetic.
Article on the internet just this week saying that, you know, if you want to be with the times, you know, if you want to use what the kids are using, you have to wear these big headphones, not the tiny earplugs. That's not current.
Yeah. It's kind of funny how that changes, but I actually, not to get off on a weird tangent here, but I actually usually use like the over the ear, but I actually like headphones that don't, like, I don't like the earbuds, because I always wear them at headphones at work, and I used earbuds for a long time, and using them day in, day out, it was bothering my ears. So I'm all for the big on the outside of your ear headphones. But I buy like $20 Sony ones, not the $200-something Beats headphones. But anyways,
I still use the earbuds.
Yeah,
yeah, they're easier to carry around in your pocket.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they never bothered me until I was using them like 7 hours a day.
Yeah.
5 days a week, and then I think if you
you just carry a boombox on your shoulder. Don't lie to us. And a pick in your hair and a boombox.
This is Retrocast after all.
With your platform shoes and bell bottoms.
Yep. You got me.
8-track. Sophisticated.
Yeah, it's an 8-track boombox. Because none of that cassette tape crap.
Yeah.
Too much.
This is a very interesting subject that's kind of related. But my father-in-law, he doesn't listen to, like, he doesn't have an iPad or an iPhone, or his music comes still from a cassette player.
Mm-hmm.
Do you realize how much cassette players are going for? They're over $100. I mean, that's the cheapest you can get them.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Lack of demand, yeah. I think it's getting harder and harder to find VCRs, too. Because you can't buy them, you can't just go to Target and get one, you know?
Right.
So you have to order them special online. And
the prices are skyrocketing.
Yeah, because there's less demand and they can't mass produce them. Yeah.
Hmm.
That's interesting. Yeah, when you have to, like, if you try to hold on to old technology.
Retro technology is expensive.
Yep.
Don't just throw that shit out on the curb. You could sell it.
Yeah. As long as you have the place to storage shit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have one old stereo sitting in my room here, and I'm pretty glad I still have it. I don't know when I got it. You know, it must have been maybe more than 10 years ago, and it's got the record player and the two-deck, you know, cassette player.
Nice.
Cassette recorder and a radio in it. And the CD player recently gave up. You know, that's crap. You know?
Mm-hmm.
The laser doesn't do its thing anymore, but
you could sell the cassette players for a lot of money. Now's the time.
Yeah, and I noticed a while back, you know, that there was still a cassette in there in one of the decks, and I'd completely forgotten it. Didn't know what cassette that was, and it probably was in there for 2 years because I never used it.
Yeah, I remember I had a whole bunch of I just had this big box of mixtapes that I had made in middle school and high school, and a lot of them, like, no label on them, and I had no idea what was on, so it's kind of fun one afternoon a ways back just popping them in and pressing play and seeing what comes up. It's like stuff recorded off the, I remember I used to sit and
record stuff off the FM radio.
Yep. Wait for certain songs to play. Yeah.
I did that too a lot when I was like 15, 16.
Yeah.
And I had favorite radio shows, and then I would record like portions of the radio show.
But yeah. Or you'd like, I'd wait for the, like the countdowns, cause you knew that they were going to play like the current hits at some point if you wanted to get them. Unless you want to go to the store and buy a cassette single. But, yeah, I mean, I
used to record, like, at late at night, they would play, like, a new wave. And I was big into new wave at the time, but it wasn't popular, like, to have its own radio station.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you wanted to hear The Cure or Depeche Mode, I would just record it before I went to bed and then listen to it later on.
Yeah. Yeah, it was cool that you could do that. I think I still have, because I bought a nice stereo around like the late 90s, and I still, like, cassettes were still enough of a thing that I wanted a cassette player as part of it, and I think that's the only piece that I still have, because I got, well, no, I'm still actually currently using the two Bose speakers that I bought in the late 90s, and they still work like when I bought them. I have them hooked up to my newer receiver that I bought only like 3 years ago after the one I bought finally went. And this, like you said, the CD player, Norbert, like yours, mine went, that was the first thing to go. But I think I still have I don't have it hooked up, but I think I still have the original cassette, double cassette deck that I bought in the late 90s.
So. Yeah, I don't know how well tape degrades over time. I should throw some cassettes in and see if they still work. But I know the A-tracks don't do very well. That thin tape that they used to for the A-tracks, mm-hmm. they just don't sound very good anymore.
Yeah, I still have a small. I got rid of a lot of those like blank those mixtapes that I didn't even know what was on them. But I did keep a small box of actual like store bought tapes and stuff.
Yeah, I still have
kind of fun to have.
I have a bunch.
Yeah. All right, so back to Buck Rogers then. So Hieronymus, after he knocks out that guard of his, he gets in. Because he's small, he's able to get into the delivery cart that brought his food, and it's automated, so it just kind of, and like, and guards in the hallways and stuff, they're used to seeing these carts fly around, making deliveries and stuff, so he gets in there, but it ends up, unfortunately, ends up taking him to a chute where it drops off the garbage, and he goes flying down this chute and lands in this big bin of empty containers, and
gets knocked out. Yeah.
And these are all, like, their food containers all kind of look the same. They're these big cylinders, cardboard
but
cylinders.
Did you even say that he, in order to get out, he rigged that headset to knock the other guy out?
I might not have finished. I think I started to say that.
Yeah, he basically took where he was listening to music or whatever. He rigged that, and then he turned on up the volume and, like, knocked that guy unconscious.
Yeah, with, like, some insane feedback.
He said, my damn headsets aren't working anymore.
Now, I watched that scene twice, and when he walks over and twists that
knob
thing, the knob on the dashboard, and he's making the funny face, like he's in this big ass, and the guy who's wearing it, he's actually quite still. So he's making the face as if he's
making
in pain.
The face, yeah, like it's pretty cool.
Yeah, now that you mentioned that, I do remember Gary Coleman making that kind of like, he's like gritting his teeth like, oh yeah.
And he's real dramatic when he's turning the knob.
Yeah. Like,
it's real dramatic in posture.
Yeah, he sells it. It's pretty cool.
Wilma's there and she finds him in that contraption, and then Buck and his the president's bodyguard have to get over this shield, and I love how he like says, well, have you ever watched the circus or whatever, and he like throws her over and she lands on her elbows and she's like, well, I guess my elbows are the least attractive part of me.
Yeah, it's kind of like a force field barrier, and they have these and now that you mentioned Lost, this is totally a thing from Lost too. I think that they were watching Buck Rogers because they have these exact same kind of
contraptions. Yeah,
contraptions where they're like the columns, and in between the columns, there's a force field, and it's probably cheap to do on television because the actors are just pretending that there's a force field there.
Yeah,
but he throws her over top of it, and then they get to a photon shield, which was mentioned earlier in the episode, that is all around this planet and stuff, and it looks just like like old television static on the ground,
right? Yeah. This is blue thing.
Yeah, and it's,
and then when, yeah, and they've got the bodyguard has this small ball shaped device, you know, that can turn off those waves to make a corridor, and when she creates, well, when it hits the ground, then you can see that there's simply a passageway where that static stuff is cut out, and they just make the green grass part visible in the middle.
Yeah,
perfectly straight.
Yeah, and that was probably some of the worst special effects that I've seen so far on the show. When she throws that ball, it's just this little like white spot on the screen that lands on the photon shield and makes a path. But
I love the fight scenes though, especially between Buck and the super powered henchmen, because again, you can see the stunt doubles, man.
I know, and Barb
was watching it with me, and we were just laughing. But I was like, Barb, wait, look, you can tell it's not the actors.
Yeah,
it's so obvious, man.
I know,
the thing that amazes me though is how Gil Gerard and the other actors couldn't do these things because they were horribly choreographed anyway. It's like,
yeah, all their fights are like barroom fights. You know, they just fall into tables.
Yeah, but they don't do much. They might do a jump kick, and that's the strenuous thing they have to do.
Uh-huh. And even mentioned in that on previous episodes, and I guess I wasn't paying as good attention or something, but this time I made a note because I totally saw it this time. And this may be even worse than other occasions because I saw it too, that the stunt double for that. And it's they don't even
try to get
exactly
those.
Yeah. Now later in the episode they have another fight with them, and they do film it so that when the stunt, it's kind of like the guy's back is to the camera.
Yeah.
So they stage that one so that they don't. But like that's an exception, because most of the time, the way they stage the fights and the way that they place the camera, like how close it is to the actor, there's just no attempt made whatsoever to disguise that it's not the same dude.
They don't even make an attempt to get the body types very similar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're either lanky, like either skinnier or shorter, or do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you look at the proportions of the actors when they start the fight and when they during the fight, it's different.
Yeah, yeah, it's just totally like a different person in the same outfit and wig.
It's so much. So, this episode was fun. This one was just like the other one. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. So, but yeah, Deering. You mentioned she finds him, and she does that by, like I alluded to earlier, she uses the technology in the job that she's in her cover, and she's there after hours, and she's there sort of right before the morning shift comes in, and she's using their communication capabilities to set something up, and I was cracking up because the evil robot boss comes in and catches her, but he doesn't. He just thinks that she's setting up a robbery. Just thinks that she's conspiring to steal, and so she lets him think that because it's better than him knowing what she's actually doing. And she's wondering if he's going to turn him in, and he doesn't even give a crap. He's just he actually thanks her for confirming his suspicions that humans are scum. So he's just totally a. I don't know what kind of an ist, but he's some kind of an ist, if not a racist. I don't know if you can be a racist if you're a robot and hate humans, but some speciesist or something.
Yeah, you're going to go rob these people. That's why you're listening to these voices.
Yeah, so eventually we have a showdown in the office of Roderick Zale. And I was laughing because, you know, he uses his Kryptonian dude, just call him that, to try to intimidate Buck and Lieutenant Dia. And he's like, there are many ways to die, long and short. In other words, to say, yeah, you may not be afraid to die, but we could torture you before we kill you. And it cuts to the little enforcer guy, and he's just got this like random, I don't know if it's a gun or like what it is, but it's just this random piece of metal that's like maybe like 3 inches long in his hands or something, and he just twists it in front of them, and that's supposed to be like this really scary moment, like to intimidate them, and it just does not work. It's just like, oh, you can bend that like cheap looking piece of metal or whatever it is in your hands. So,
well, he already knew he was strong because he already had that fight with them,
right? Yeah, I don't know how that was supposed to scare them, but
well, he would have kicked Buck's ass in a straight fight. He was throwing Buck around the whole room.
Yeah. so I think Buck already knew it. Maybe the display was unnecessary.
Yeah.
But, so even though Wilma gets Hieronymus out, Hieronymus insists on going back in. I think it was it to rescue Lieutenant Dia? Cause he's found out by this point that she's there with Buck.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's why, that's why they want to get, he goes back in and Wilma's communicating with Dr. Hewer back on Earth and he's freaking out because she's rescued the president, and then the president's actually, he smuggles his way back in by using his size again. He hides himself inside of a food container, knowing that he can sneak into the complex that way. And then from my notes, I'm kind of unclear on how we get from there to the ending piece when they're all back together again.
It was very abrupt.
Yeah. I think that's why I don't have many notes about it.
They basically had that showdown in the room and then they took over, and then it's like Party Central back on Earth.
Yeah, so
they're like partying again, and they're actually eating like cheeseburgers and all kinds of stuff.
Mexican chili.
Oh, Mexican chili, that's right.
Yeah, Buck made Mexican chili, and only him and the only meat that they could get was uncooked mountain lizard. and Buck and Hieronymus are the only ones that know that that's what the meat is in the chili.
Yeah, because he was like, maybe next time less scales or something.
Yeah. There's like too many scales in the chili. if he wants them to make some more, but with less scales. And then we have like a little Twiggy and Hieronymus have a little showdown because Twiggy like makes a snide remark about the president, and Gary Coleman gets up and gets in his face.
He made a size remark, like me and being
right,
short,
yeah.
Because yeah. Gary Coleman was smaller than Twiggy.
Yeah, by a couple inches. So he gets up and gets in Twiggy's face and says, "You want to say that again, transistor face?" I like that. But
and so Twiggy goes into the mode where he can't be understood, and you know he's just saying like, "Fuck you."
He starts doing his beady, beady, beady. What did he say? But
Dr. Theopolis always has to translate for him.
Yeah.
But Theopolis knows not to... He always says stuff politically mm-hmm. correct or changes what he says in mm-hmm. circumstances like this.
Mm-hmm. He said, you're welcome, Mr. President.
Yeah, but you know he didn't say that.
You know what? They got all that from that C-3PO and R2-D2, because R2-D2 doesn't listen to humans and wants to do his own thing, and he can only beep. And then we got C-3PO in Star Wars, you know, who is the diplomat, and he makes it clear what R2-D2 said or probably didn't say.
Oh, that's true. C-3PO does the same thing in the Star Wars a couple times where he takes what R2-D2 beeped and changes it, or you can tell in the same way.
Only difference is Twiggy can speak English if he wants to.
Yeah, yeah. They couldn't resist having him say funny
Buck-isms,
stuff.
Buckisms, yeah.
Yeah. Stuff that he learned from his buddy Buck.
Yeah, voiced by Mel Blanc.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it was a pretty funny episode. It's been a long time since I've seen young Gary Coleman in something. You know, I used to watch Different Strokes when I was a kid, and and then eventually before his death, he had kind of become a butt of a lot of jokes and really had a lot of problems as an adult, financial struggles and depression and stuff.
A lot of health problems too.
Legal problems, but yeah, a lot of it did stem from his health problems and stuff. And ultimately, like when you look back at his history, I mean, he had a lot of talent. And what started the whole financial problems was because of his parents really took advantage of him as a child when the money that was coming in. He a lot of it was taken from him before he ever before he ever got any of it himself. So it's like just thinking about him and remembering him, going back and looking at his history and stuff, it ultimately is pretty sad.
Yeah, they actually got him on that VH1 show where they'd get a bunch of celebrities to live in the same house.
Right.
That was like a disaster because you had a bunch of like ego people. And, yeah. And when he was on that show, he actually left the show. Mm-hmm. Like he couldn't take it. But
yeah, a lot of his later life, there was a lot of like, you know, it was kind of his situation is kind of exploited. I mean, he was just trying to make money. And, you know, you have these situations, like you said, the VH1 show and stuff like that, where take the opportunity because that was the only opportunities he's had, but it was really kind of like, it wasn't like respectful. It was to sort of make money off of his
situation. That whole show was a sad show because it was a bunch of like people that had it made and for whatever reason lost their money, or you know what I mean? Like it had like Bridget Nielsen and the guy with the clocks, the rapper, forget what his name is, and
Flavor Flav,
and it was a weird show, but it was depressing because mm-hmm. you even got to see Vanilla Ice, you know, and he hated his past, like he didn't want anything to do with it, like he wanted to move on.
Yeah,
and it was that show was sad because it did exploit them for what they were and what they are now.
Yeah.
I don't think I would have ever signed up for that.
There's a VH1 kind of... it's funny because I remember, like, when I was a kid, I thought of VH1 as the grown-up music channel. You know, they, like, MTV played the cool stuff, and VH1 played the videos, the stuff that, like, adults would want to listen to.
Now it's the opposite. VH1 has better stuff than MTV. MTV's, like, all this reality-based shit.
Like yeah, well, I mean, teenage, in VH1,
pregnant mom and all this, MTV is fucked up. I mean, what happened to MTV? Like, it doesn't even have a music connection anymore, does it?
Well, VH1 has gone the same way too, though. I mean,
no, but I at least find stuff on VH1 that I'll watch. Like, mm-hmm. it has some videos every now and then, and there's some like old 80s sitcoms. I mean, not sitcoms, but movies.
Mm-hmm. The programs you were talking about, though, with like Gary Coleman and stuff, those and the Flavor Flav show and stuff, those are all VH1 shows. But I think with both of them, changing market. Like if they were still just showing music videos, they probably wouldn't be on the air anymore.
Yeah,
I think that changed more than 10 years ago. I remember when I was in Hamburg. You know, that was 10 years ago, and it was. In my journalism course and then doing this internship, and we were in this editorial office building in Hamburg, and when you walk down the stairs to the lobby, there was a cinema in there, and you could get some free magazines like from a rack there next to the cinema, and there's this one magazine called Intro, and one day I walked down there to get that copy of Intro, and it had an editorial piece about MTV, and I said, well, MTV is all dating shows now. It's like teen dating stuff, and the reality thing was just beginning, and then they were talking about like the changing market, you know, with music videos, and that had stopped being a focus for MTV, and they were making money off of the dating shows and the prank shows, and I think what was that stupid one, Jackass, you know, that had been really big, and then after Jackass they did the dating shows and the Date My Mom and other stuff, and then Paris Hilton had a show, and she did what was that, where she was an intern, or she was it was her and Nicole Richie, like living with poor people. That was.
Oh yeah.
And then they just got more and more reality shows, and they had the Osbournes, and then Gene Simmons from Kiss had a reality show, and the guy from Poison, the rock group, he had a reality show. And
I think that's all it is right now. Yeah. Like, I don't even watch MTV, nor do I have any desire to. They are involved something in comics now, though. Like, I don't know if they televise that, but
I think it's more of like they've.
I think it's on the web.
Yeah, they've upped their like web content to sort of compete with like sites like IGN and stuff, where they cover a lot of pop culture stuff on the. So I've ended up looking at some articles that I don't go directly to the site, but I've ended up reading some articles. Like just recently, there was an article. I ended up on their site because there was an article with Scott Snyder about Batman Eternal number 1. But I can't even tell you the last time I actually watched the channel on television, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yeah, back in the day, I mean, talking about retro, though, I mean, back in the day, I would, once I got old enough, I would stay up late at night in high school and stuff to watch 120 Minutes. And I used to tape like indie rock videos and stuff like that off 120 Minutes or Headbangers Ball. You know, they had these late night shows that you'd see these videos that you would never see anywhere else. And you couldn't just like nowadays, like you couldn't just hop on the internet. Like the internet existed, but you couldn't stream video or anything at that point. And so it was the only way to catch some of these videos unless you were going to go and like wait till like a band released their like home video on home video release of their videos or something. But yeah, times have changed.
I remember they still had announcements for when they were going to debut this video.
Mm-hmm.
Like with the big stars would say, well, we know you're waiting for the latest Prince video, and the Prince video will be shown, you know, Saturday at 10 or something, whatever the time was. And then everybody had to tune into that show, or the latest Madonna video and the latest Michael Jackson or Guns N' Roses. You know, those were big.
Yeah, I mean, even into like the 90s and stuff, that was still a thing. Like when I remember, there would be, you know, they would let you know ahead of time when like the new Nirvana or Smashing Pumpkins video would be aired. And it was like a big deal, and they would put a lot of money into these. They'd have really big budgets for these videos because they were, you know, sometimes the impressiveness of the video would be something that would contribute to the song being popular, you know. Now I don't think they still make videos, but I mean, I don't even, most people don't even really see them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But
you have to go to YouTube to see videos nowadays.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, so I know I have one question that I got earlier in the week from Joel Eustace, and I don't know if there's any others that we've gotten. Mike, did you have any?
No, I didn't put anything out.
Yeah, me neither. But Joel offered this question earlier in the week, so we can address this if you wanna.
Sure.
It is, what was your first indie comic bought when you were younger? And he's got indie in quotes. I'm thinking, to me that means, you know, like anything other than DC or Marvel. His was a copy of the 10th issue of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which blew his mind. And he also had a Space Beaver comic by Derek Robertson. So he was wondering, you know, what were our earliest or indie comics that weren't DC or Marvel?
Well, my earliest ones was, we used to go to the garbage dump, and I read a lot of Archie. That's not Marvel or DC. But I don't have, like, specific, because they used to rip off the covers. So I don't remember. My first store-bought one that actually had a cover was Judge Dredd number 7 from Eagle Comics, which was basically taking the UK property and bringing it to America.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. the two that come to mind, I can't be sure if they're exactly the case, but one of the first ones I remember, I mean, I know the first time I ever bought a bunch of stuff that wasn't Marvel or DC was when Image launched, but prior to that, you know, Valiant had popped up, and I didn't get a lot of Valiant because it was, they became hard to find for someone at my age at that time. I wasn't driving. I was reliant upon parents to get me to the store, so I couldn't always be there on Wednesdays and stuff.
Hard to find and expensive if you wanted to go in the back market.
Right.
It was so ridiculously expensive and inflated.
Yeah.
Thanks to Wizard Magazine.
Yeah. But I do know that I did have a copy of Turok number one, because that was like a huge print run. So that's one of the earliest ones I could think of. The other one was, I don't even know how I ended up with it, but I think I probably picked it up because it was, it looked like the Ninja Turtles to me, which was Adolescent Radioactive Black Belt Hamsters, which was, it was actually, I don't think he worked on the first couple issues, but Sam Keith ended up being involved with it. But it was like probably the first spoof of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And, you know, just it was hamsters instead of turtles. And
yeah, I wished I would have had the Ninja Turtle stuff. But yeah. At my age, when I was going to the comic shop, I had no interest in things that I thought were goofy. Like mm-hmm. even in DC, when they came out with Captain Carrot and the Zoo Crew, I had no interest in that whatsoever. I mean, times have changed, but back mm-hmm. then I just wanted my comics to be serious.
Yeah.
Although I did read another comic that I now that you mentioned that I did get from that time was a book called Normal Man from Aardvark Vanaheim, and that was Jim Valentino was the writer and artist. Mm-hmm. And I got a few issues of that around the same time as Judge Dredd.
Nice. And
it was a funny comic. He was like in a world, like if you ever look at the covers of Normal Man, it's like you have this goofy. The first cover is a mock off of Kryptonian, like them launching Superman into space, and Normal Man's in the rocket. The second issue is a knockoff of Amazing Spider-Man, but the whole thing is he's a guy that's just a regular Joe in a world full of abnormal things,
mm-hmm.
and you know they make fun of like ElfQuest and Richie Rich and. It's just, it was a fun comic. I should go back and complete that sometime. That was fun.
Nice, yeah, I don't think I'm familiar with that one. Norbert, do you remember?
So many that come to mind right now. First I thought, in terms of comic books that were not a property by Marvel or DC Comics, I remember buying a Vampirella at a flea market, mm. and that was in the late 80s, but the issue was actually from 1973, so that was probably the first comic that I bought that was older.
Was it a magazine, 1973?
It was a magazine it was translated, but it was based on the old Vampirella, like back when it was in black and white.
The War magazine, yeah.
Yeah, as the storyteller, she was doing these intros to other series, and most of it was just generic horror short stories. It was a bit like the Twilight Zone or Tales from the Crypt, you know, that format.
Mm-hmm.
Or just these self-contained short stories and one Vampirella story. And yeah, that was the first Vampirella I had, and then yeah, I came back to Vampirella in the 90s when she was on Harris Comics. Yeah, but even before that, I read different comics. I had a bunch of European ones. There was even, I wouldn't call it indie comic, but there's a comic book that's published by one of the banks in my area. They make this into to get like little kids to learn about banks and opening their first bank account. Then there's this advertising comic that called Knocks, you know, and it's set in this sort of medieval city. And they have the good people in there who are saving money and doing their thing, you know, working jobs and they're saving the money. And then they have a bad guy who always wants to steal their gold and is like an evil knight, you know, looking for these bags of gold. And the whole thing is basically a you know, an ad piece for that chain of banks. And I remember I read that in first grade or second grade. But in terms of more serious comics, I liked ElfQuest a lot. Mm. And I'm not sure who published it. It was the company was called Warp Graphics, and Father Tree Press was the label created, I think, by Wendy and Richard Pini.
Mm-hmm.
The series they create, they have the Father Tree imprint. And I read the original run of that, like the original story. And that would go on for most of the 80s. I read that in an album format, you know, by that time they had colored it. Like originally, ElfQuest started in 77 and it was in black and white. But those earliest issues, they were redone in color and then, you know, published several times. I really like that story. And then another one that I just checked here on the website, so I got the name right. That was also one I got in a weird European album format where the album was a bit like, it was a book format where the page is wider than it is tall.
Mm.
Like they're republishing the old Flash Gordon. Everything was a newspaper strip in the 30s, or Tarzan or something. And when you republish that, the page is wider than it is tall. And I had one of that from a comic called AXA, you know, AXA. And that was originally a British series. And it says here on Wikipedia, it was originally done by the British daily tabloid The Sun from 1978 to 1986. And it was always written by a guy named Donny Avenel and drawn by Romero. And I remember it was in black and white except for the cover. And AXA was this very scantily clad barbarian woman with sometimes with a sword or whatever weapon she could get. And it was set in this post-apocalyptic, post-nuclear war world where everything was destroyed and people lived in these barbarian tribes. They had some technology or some pockets where they had like these domed cities where there was a dictatorship or the robots ruled or whatever. And then AXA would just be cast from place to place, and there was always somebody who wanted to enslave her, or they wanted to bring her to the city to be a breeder. Like they had women captured there for breeding, and then they had so few healthy women that you know that was like a currency to them to have healthy women as breeding slaves. And you know, I fondly remember that because that was the first like dangerous comic. That was the first like unsavory one that I could get my hands on. First comic I had to like hide under the bed didn't want your mom and dad to know about it.
Yeah.
It looks interesting because it looks like in America that Eclipse got a hold of that and restarted reprinting it.
Is it just AXA? Is that
AXA Comics? Yeah, but then you see covers from like other publishers, and in other languages, and it is very risque because there's a lot. It looks like there's a lot of nudity.
Mm. Yeah, she was usually topless.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of fits in with the, because nowadays the Sun is known for, like, pictures of actual photographs of like topless British models.
Mm. Yeah, it's like Bild in Germany. We have this newspaper called the Bild, B-I-L-D, and that's a tabloid known for very short articles. They usually have just a few lines of articles. And it's very sensationalist. Like, it's known to be, just very populist, sensationalist. You know, and just gives a few flashy headlines, and they also have a nude woman on the title page. Like, every issue, that sort of nude girl of the day.
Yeah, yeah. I think
it seems like depending on the country, though, that AXA is censored in some respects. Because I'm looking at the Eclipse one, and it looks really tame. But if I look at the covers from... it says Rainer Feist Verlag. I don't know the publisher. Yeah, that's
probably what I had. That was published in Vienna, Austria. And that's the Wiener Verlag. They also published Flash Gordon at one point.
There's a lot of nudity in that. But then there's the Ken Pierce one, 1983, and I don't know if this is... It looks like this might be reprints, because it's got the Romero as the artist. So this might be, like, if anybody's interested to check this out, they could search out the AXA Ken Pierce run, which runs 1 through 9, and it looks like it's reprints. But it says American edition, so I don't know if they've tamed it. It looks like they have on the covers for sure.
Mm.
Maybe they took all the nudity out of the book. And it's not listed in my database as being mature readers, so I imagine that if she was topless, that they would have drawn a something over her breasts.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like the Romero originals, though.
Yeah, if you could get this Rainer Feist Verlag one, the covers look very nice.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of what more recently, is it Frank Cho? He originally wanted to do the more of like a mature readers thing with Marvel's...
Shauna the She-Devil?
Shauna, and then they didn't want to go that route, so he ended up doing like an independent Jungle Girl comic that was pretty much the same character, but... had nudity in it.
But I thought Jungle Girl was released on Dynamite.
Yeah, it was like independent, but it was...
I don't remember there being nudity in there.
Maybe I'm embellishing it.
Yeah, she's got her jungle bra on.
Yeah. So I think no matter where he went, unless he self-published, he does like to do nudity, though, because I follow him on Facebook, and he does Apes and Babes or something like that. And... there's a lot of nudity in his face, I guess, with what he could get away with on Facebook.
Yeah, maybe I was just looking at, like, original, or maybe it was, I don't know. I might have just been making it better in my head.
Well, Norbert's are familiar with Jungle Girl, right? You were mentioning that on the Dynamite page that I created.
On that Facebook group, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it probably takes you back to the The X.
That was a fun comic. I think I have all the issues of that, and then I bought the Shanna the She-Devil, and it looked like just the same character. I know it wasn't her, but it was Frank Cho doing the art, and he could go, you know, immediately from Jungle Girl to Shanna. And Jungle Girl also had a name, and I forgot it. She had a first name.
Yeah, I could see that.
They have a new Shanna, a Shanna book, which is not Shanna the She-Devil, but Shanna from Moonstone Publishing that's coming out right now. So if you're into the Jungle Girl phenomena, there's a way to get that. And there was also a Kickstarter I supported with another Jungle Girl, but I don't remember what that one was called.
So I think that's it for the questions. But that was, got some good mileage out of that. And I wanted to, before I forget, I wanted to shout out another podcast by a listener, David Levine, who I believe started listening because of the Buck Rogers coverage we were doing, and David has put some comments up on episodes on Facebook that we've done, and his you know, his experience watching Buck Rogers and stuff. And I found out recently that he actually has a podcast of his own called Dave Talks Comics. And you can find it at DaveTalksComics.com. It's kind of similar. If you like this show, if you listen to the solo show I do, Myth Making, etc., it's kind of like that. He talks old comics. It's a solo podcast that runs from like 20 to 40 minutes, somewhere in there. And he'll actually, what he does is he'll actually talk about a number of different issues. Rather than go in depth page by page on a single issue, he'll talk about a bunch of different stuff that he's been reading lately. So just wanted to shout that out since I found out about it recently. He just released, I think he's doing it like biweekly or monthly whenever he gets one out. He just released episode 19 this week, so he's been doing it since like last summer. And he'll talk about if he's gone to a convention or something like that recently, and he'll occasionally also talk about comic book related animated TV shows. So check that out if it sounds interesting. And speaking of comics, do you want to get into talking about some old comics?
Sure.
Norbert, did you want to talk about something?
Oh, you know what? I was going to read my issues of Warlord this week, and I didn't get around to them. They're still, you know, in a stack, and each is still in the poly bag. But I got those recently because I wanted to read something that was Sword and Sorcery. And then I find a nice retailer that had like a complete 70s, early 80s run of The Lost World of the Warlord.
Cool.
Right. And
is it translated or is it in English?
No, that's the American issue.
Okay.
Right. DC Comics. Yeah, because I remember that character, the Warlord, from a reboot, like a recent thing that I did a few years back. And I only had the number one of that. And I remember not liking it very much. But then I saw that, you know, in the early 80s, they had a line of action figures based on Warlord. Mm. They also had a version of Hercules in that series.
In Arak.
Uh-huh. And yeah, I just wanted to explore it a little and research the old run. And I could have gotten the number one of Warlord. I mean, that guy still has it, but it costs so much on that website that I could have gotten like 7 or 8 other comics for it. who wanted
to. His first appearance isn't in Warlord. It's first issue special, but then it goes into Warlord number one.
Mm-hmm.
I love. It's created and written and drawn by Mike Grell, and right. It's just fascinating. And I'm honored to say I have an original Warlord Mike Grell sketch that I got from a con of Warlord. But he drew some of the sexiest women I've ever seen in comics, I swear. There's like three or four of them in that book that are prominent characters with Warlord. One of them's a shapeshifter. Like, she can shapeshift into this cat-like being.
Mm-hmm.
But that series is awesome. And the action figures that you're talking about, I think about 2 months ago, I was like trying to find them on eBay, and I can't really find the characters. I could find them, but they looked beat up, like they were mm-hmm. in some 5-year-old's box, and I want something more, a little more pristine for not that expensive. But it was the time when DC got into the toys, but it was a very weird time. Like Remco put out Arak. I think there was two Warlord characters, Deimos, who's Warlord's villain, and then Hercules, which was in the 70s comic that DC was publishing as well. They also delved into Sergeant Rock, but the Sergeant Rock line was put in there, I think, to go against G.I. Joe and stuff. But it was a weird line because I expected to see like Sergeant Rock, Ice Cream Soldier, Bulldozer, all the different guys that were with him, and I didn't see them named that way. They were just like military infantry. So, but yeah, that's interesting stuff. It's you're in for a treat, I think, Norbert. I think you're gonna really love the world that he built. It's an inner Earth, so it's about an Air Force pilot that crashes and ends up in this world that's always lit, and I think it has two suns, but it's inside of Earth. It's Skataris, and it's fun. I mean, and the art is amazing. And I think the series that you're referring to that was a dud was the Bruce Jones one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which was different. It had Bart Sears pencils and Bert Butch did the writing. Bruce Jones did the writing, sorry.
Yeah, I have no experience with Warlord, but it's something I'm aware of. I'd like to check out at some point because, you know, I know the Mike Grell art from Green Arrow and stuff and enjoy his work. So I'd like to check that out eventually as well.
Recently they even brought up the name Skartaris once in New 52 DC Comics. And I'm sure Mike has also read it because it was in the Channel 52 thing where that alien newscaster is always like giving you some.
You know what? You know what? I don't ever read those. And the reason I don't is because they get me mad because they have spoilers for stuff. Like they'll have like two or three panels that will spoil a book I hadn't read yet. Mm. And I like kind of skip it. Like it would be different for me, Norbert, if I didn't buy all the DCs, because like if I was buying like just the Batmans and then I saw a preview for Superman, Wonder Woman, then it would be like an advertisement for me wanting to read that. But because I get all the DCs, I try to stay away from the 52. But I haven't seen them mention Skataris.
Yeah. It was in one speech balloon, and it was mentioned in passing. I just recognized the name because I knew that was Warlord's world. And the guy was saying, well, in addition to the commotion or the incident in Skartaris, we also have this report from Metropolis and something like that.
Ah.
It was one sentence, and when they said there's something going on in Scar Terrace, but we have no pictures from that or something.
Well, maybe they are coming up with something, because I found out they're canceling a lot of books, so maybe they're going to replace them with something.
Yeah, I saw you post about that. Is that information that you got to keep to yourself for now?
Yeah, for now.
Yeah.
I don't think I should have found out about it. I just did. Doing another podcast and CK's a retailer.
It's usually pretty easy to guess anyways.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to guess, but one of them breaks my heart. I understand why. I mean, if you ever want to know, just go to the bottom of what's selling, and you'll pretty much be able to pick off what books that are going to be axed.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can only get so upset about it because...
There'll be some other comic to replace it. I mean,
they're not running a charity, you know.
Yeah, it's a business,
You know, they gotta do what they gotta do.
I just wish that more people would like what I like, but I think that's what everybody wishes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's never the case, but
except for like the Batman and Spider-Man fans,
you'll always find those being popular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they.
So did you get you did get a full run minus issue number one? Is that what you're saying?
No, not yet. But if I throw more money at it, you know,
you should dig into one and see if you like it first.
Yeah,
I think if you read two or three issues, you'll know if you're gonna enjoy that. Mm-hmm. I think you'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
It is good fantasy comics. I mean, it really is.
I got five or six of them at once, and I picked the back issues from that website based on the covers. I just got some interesting covers. And one has got an ad, you know, from, what was that? Like 78, when I said, you have to watch for the Superman movie, right? The first one, 78. And then when Superman 2 came out, they also featured that on the cover. And, well, the earliest I have here is Warlord number 3. And I'm going to read that later today.
Yeah, I think besides...
There's a website by Mike Grell. I just checked it. And he still has a page up for the Warlord. It's mikegrell.com/the Warlord.
I think besides issue one, you probably won't have trouble. Most of the other issues will probably be fairly inexpensive, I think. But.
Yeah, I have a full run. I have everything Warlord except for the annuals, which I don't know why I don't, but I need to get them.
Yeah, sometimes I forget about annuals when I'm collecting stuff. It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah, I forget. Or I went through these annual phase when I didn't want to read them because I didn't feel like they were connected. I don't know how, but then annuals would like, you know, they would suck me back in with like Armageddon 2001 or, mm-hmm. you know, the Elseworlds annuals. They'll have like a theme of the annual, or the ones with the aliens where they, you know, had introduced Hitman and all that crap, mm-hmm. And then the Demon annual, that stuff like I really got into, but. If I was going to miss anything, it was going to be the annual. I hate to say this, but I never respected the annual. It had a lot of pages, and I never could get into all of it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like there was two good stories and then a lot of inventory in the annual. Like, reprints and stuff, and I just got frustrated and left the annual.
Yeah, it depends. You never know what you're going to get. Sometimes they're pretty well related, and then other times not. It's hard to know which it's going to be.
The very sad thing is, as Norbert was talking about Warlord, I was looking at my database, and I was like, okay, I've read almost everything ever to come out. But there is a series in 2009 to 2010 that I have to have somewhere, but I didn't read it because it's not inventoried. And usually I don't inventory until I read.
Hmm.
So, and it's by Mike Grell. So I gotta go dig in those boxes today, see if I have this.
We gotta track it down.
Yeah.
Search the library. Well, I read a 2-issue storyline in of Captain America.
Nice.
Out of the Epic Collection.
What issues?
It is 253 and 254. So this is almost the end of the very short Roger Stern, John Byrne run on Cap, where they had done the Captain America for President storyline before this. And 255 was actually their last issue, which is like a recap of, no pun intended, of the Captain America origin story, where they follow close to the line, but they kind of like update a little bit. And after their short run, there was kind of a sequence of like fill-ins before J.M. DeMatteis started his run, I think in like 262 or something like that, and he was on the book for a while. But anyways, 253 and 254, so these issues are both written by Stern, drawn by Byrne, and co-plotted by the two of them. They both are inked by Joe Rubinstein, and colored by Bob Sharon, edited by Jim Salakrup. And the letters on 253 are Jim Novak, and 254 are Joe Rosen. And the titles, 253 is called Should Old Acquaintance Be Forgot, and 254 is called Blood on the Moors. And basically this is, they wanted to sort of do a storyline that would tie into Cap's Invaders past. Steve and Bernie Rosenthal are on their first date, and Steve takes her to see Oklahoma, and she doesn't know at this point that he's Captain America and that he's actually, that he grew up in a different era and stuff, and that's why his tastes are old fashioned. She just thinks that he's a young guy with old taste. They're just about to start making out, and the phone rings, and it's Jarvis from Avengers Mansion. He has a message that they've received by cable, and it's coded. It's like it's in code, and it's actually from it's signed Fallsworth, and so he recognizes that name, and he has to make an excuse to Bernie that he needs to leave immediately for England, and so she's kind of upset with them. She makes up a story that, she's like, okay, that's fine. I actually got an old boyfriend coming to town. I'm supposed to get together with him. And we can see her thoughts and know that she's actually, it's not true. And she's kind of feeling sort of dumb after she says it, because she realized she just said it to try to, cause she was feeling upset that he was leaving, cause she doesn't know he's Captain America at this point. But, I knew that this story, I'm thinking, okay, Captain America's going to England, and this is going to deal with vampires in some respect. I'm thinking this is sort of a strange setting for a Captain America story, but it ended up being really cool the way that it ties into his history and stuff. He goes to England, and he visits the Fallsworth Mansion, and Lord Fallsworth is the original Union Jack, the original British superhero, and his daughter was Spitfire, and she's the widow of the second Union Jack, and we actually find out in the story that this is where we're notified that the second Union Jack died in a car accident. So there's been some attacks around town, and the reason that they call him is because Lord Falsworth, he's a really old man now, he's in a wheelchair, he's convinced that the attacks around town are Baron Blood, who is actually, we get an origin of Baron Blood in 254, and Baron Blood is actually his brother. So he took sort of the inheritance, and his brother went down a dark path because he didn't receive the inheritance that his brother got, and was turned into Baron Blood eventually. So no one really believes Lord Falsworth that it's Baron Blood, but Captain America looks at him and sees, you know, this guy, his mind is still with him, and so we're gonna, like, I'm out of respect for him and his history, I'm gonna go ahead and investigate this. So meanwhile, Spitfire, like Lady Falsworth, like Lord Falsworth's daughter, her son, Kenneth Falsworth, comes home from school, and he brings his buddy Joey Chapman. And Joey Chapman's a member of, like, the lower class, and so she's kind of upset about that because the Falsworths are, like, British money. And even, so after Baron Blood attacks their house one morning, even Captain America is suspicious of Chapman because he shows up, like, he sleeps through the whole thing, and he shows up just after the Baron attacks, and Captain says, you know, where were you this whole time? You know, I don't think you're Baron Blood, but vampires are known to have human servants, and he's pretty suspicious of him, and Kenneth vouches for his friend, saying, you know, he always sleeps late, and he sleeps like a rock. It's no surprise to me that he slept through the attack. So Lord Falsworth, at one point, he starts putting on his old Union Jack costume, even though he's like a feeble old man. And it could be kind of funny if it was not played right by the writer and artist, but it's pretty touching because he's this old guy. He still has his dignity about him, and he knows that it's his brother that's the one that's responsible. And, you know, he's like, it's a Falsworth problem, and we Falsworth, we take care of our own problems. And so he still has his dignity about him. He wants to, even though it's kind of, you know, an old man dressing up in a superhero costume, he doesn't have any powers anymore. You know, his daughter doesn't have the powers that made her Spitfire anymore.
So he's the first Union Jack.
Yeah.
The second Union Jack is dead, and they're introducing the third Union Jack.
Yes. This is actually, turns out to be, the storyline is actually the first appearance of the third and current Union Jack. So, you know, this Stern and Byrne are, besides rhyming, are the team that are actually credited as creating the third Union Jack, even though all they did was introduce him, and everything that came after was done by other people. They introduced him and then didn't, because they left the book, didn't have a chance to do anything with them. But Stern, so just to get there, Lord Falsworth, right after putting on his Union Jack costume, has a heart attack. So we think that he's laid up in a hospital. And we know at this point that Baron Blood has been posing, using a disguise as the local doctor in the town. And he's been doing that so that he can discreetly feed off of a townswoman to, you know, to satisfy his urges as a vampire. And so he thinks that he's got his brother trapped at this point, because he closes the door and he takes off his disguise and reveals that he's actually Baron Blood and Union Jack laying in the bed. We think it's Lord Falsworth, but he pulls out a silver weapon and attacks, and then he jumps out with agility that an old man definitely does not have, and kicks Baron across the face. And so there's a fight. Captain America shows up. It turns out to be a setup. Between the two of them, Captain America and Union Jack, they take out Baron Blood, and It's kind of a neat sequence where it's all focused on Captain America's face, and he's struggling with what he knows he has to do, and he thinks back to what Lord Falsworth told him about what you need to do to permanently take out a vampire. And so we don't see it. We just see like the reaction shot from the people around, but he decapitates Baron Blood with his shield. And then they reveal that Joey Chapman is the one that's the new Union Jack. And it's kind of interesting because it sets up something that happens later, that Kenneth, you know, is comes to the door, and Kenneth, he would be, you know, he's the son of the second and the grandson of the first Union Jack, but he says something to the effect that, you know, you're the stronger one, Joey. It made sense for you to disguise yourself as Union Jack. And Joey said, yeah, you know, yeah, if you're lucky that you weren't the one to do this fight, because you might not have been able to handle him. And so then it ends with them burning the body of Baron Blood, and Lord Falsworth passes away in his chair, in his wheelchair. And the last page is kind of a tribute to him and to the history of the hero. And in the back of the book, there's actually an interview with Roger Stern about his run on Captain America, and the interview was done in 2007. And there is a passage in the interview where they talk about this story, and it actually, he says that they particularly wanted to do a Union Jack that was from the lower class, that instead of from the British upper class, since they were the soldiers in any war are usually made up of the the common people. So they wanted to introduce a Union Jack, a British hero that was a commoner. As mentioned, this storyline kind of yields a lot of fruit for future writers, because Kenneth Falsworth, he ends up becoming a new Baron Blood later on. And Joey continues to be Union Jack. I mean, he's made appearances as Union Jack in recent years. And at one point, his Kenneth's mother, the original Spitfire, she gets de-aged to a teenage body again, and even ends up, I think for a while, in a relationship with Joey Chapman. So there's a lot of continues to be a lot of fruit that comes out of the storyline and later Captain America stories and stuff. Even during the Brubaker run, there was stuff that pulled in stuff from this story. But it ended up being kind of a story I went into a little trepidatious, okay, Captain America in Britain and, a vampire of some sorts, but I ended up liking it because of how it tied back into past comic history and stuff.
There's a whole legacy there too.
Yeah, all the legacy characters and stuff. I mean, you don't always get a lot of legacy characters in Marvel as much as you do in pre-52 DC, but when they do, you know, they do have that background of the 40s timely.
Are you there?
Well, I'm still here, Bernard.
Oh, I hit. Sorry, accidentally.
No, you're back. You're back.
I was you got cut in midair there.
Yeah, I actually bumped my mute button with my elbow. But anyways, yeah, I was just saying that the timely comics history, and it's interesting when they will draw upon that with Marvel. So I ended up really liking the storyline. It's cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, my comic that I'm going to talk about, I didn't know it existed. It's weird because it's a DC comic. I didn't know this title existed. But it's Weird Mystery Tales from 1972. Mm. This series ran 24 issues. And the reason I ran across it was because I follow many Jack Kirby pages on Facebook. And somebody had a two-page spread of Toxel, which is a character I think that Kirby created, And I was blown away by the two-page spread, and I said, how do I not know about this? So I went and purchased it on eBay. Interesting enough, this came with like a certificate of authenticity that it came from the Time Warp collection. There's a comic shop in Boulder called Time Warp, and I guess this came from the official owner's collection, and it's in really, really nice shape. But anyway, it has a 10-page Jack Kirby story introduced by a psychiatrist that's talking about a key, and it talks about this Toxel who's trying to invade this power plant of sort, and he has a key to it, and they're using these women are like Jack Kirby, they're dancing in front of these guards to distract them, and while they're distracted, Toxel and his barbarians invade the fortress and use the key to infiltrate the fortress, and his whole job is to get into this this it's like these cracks in the volcano, but it's supplies power to the system, and he gets in there and pretty much destroys it, and that's how the story ends. But the art is freaking amazing. I think it happened right after it would have happened maybe after Forever People and Mr. Miracle, because Commandy, it says check the first issue of Commandy that's starting up on August 29th. So it's somewhere after the issues that we talked about and Commandy. So if you want to seek this out, Kirby did work in issues 1, 2, and 3 of Weird Mystery Tales, and but that wasn't the interesting part of the story. It's not the Kirby part, which is freaking weird. But I guess the first comic is worth a lot because it's the first appearance of Destiny. You know how they have Sandman and Destiny? Well, he's in that Vertigo realm, but it is the first appearance of Destiny. And the second part of the story is freaking weird because it's a story of the Titanic, and we've all heard the story of the Titanic. But this particular story takes us it's script and art is by Howard Purcell. We know somebody named that. No, William Purcell. Inks by Jack Abel. But the interesting thing is that it's about this family that goes aboard the Titanic. George Baldwin and his wife. And their 6-year-old son, and their 6-year-old son is Gary. So his name is Gary Baldwin, and this name's important because if you want to Wikipedia it later, it has some truth to this story. But anyway, the Titanic hits the iceberg that sinks. They do get a lot of the children off of the Titanic, but the mother doesn't get off the Titanic. The father doesn't get off the Titanic. And they both drown. The son is rescued eventually by the ship, which is the Cunard Liner Carpathia. And he boards that ship. And before his father put him on the boat, he said, "Son, promise me one thing, son. Stay away from the water. My grandfather, my father both drowned at sea. Promise me you'll stay away from the sea." And the little boy at 6 years old says, "I promise, father, I'm not going to go into the sea." And so he gets raised by his aunt, Alice, and he has an incident early in life as a teenager skating in Central Park where the ice breaks and he falls through. And it's weird because he almost drowns, but the police there, they rescue him, and they're like, "Man, this is weird. This is 6 inches thick. How did this kid fall in?" And later on, when he's becoming a young man, he is on a date with a girl, and she convinces him to go swim in the ocean, and he gets pulled in by an undertow and almost dies. And after that, he says, fuck this, my dad's right, I'm going to stay away from the water. And he becomes a successful playwright and producer. And he refuses to even have water on the stage, any kind of water. He just won't have it. But anyway, this playwright becomes so popular, they option off his film in England, and he has to go overseas to London to film this movie. And he says, I am not going on a boat, because they offer him the Queen Mary and sails tomorrow. And he's like, nope, I'm going to fly. Well, the plane that he's in gets hit by lightning, and the plane crashes into the ocean. And I guess they radio ahead, and a lot of them get rescued except for him. He's stuck in the water and eventually sees this iceberg, and he sees this a floating device that's labeled RMS Titanic, and he's actually saved by the inner tube of the Titanic. So you think, well, shit, is this his father saving him? But after he was saved, he's like, I'm over my fear of water. You know, this, my father saved me. Everything's copacetic with water. And he ends up dying years later on a boat, as he drowns off of Long Island. So he did eventually die. And what it says is, this story was true. It really happened. And it actually shows the newsprint of where a prominent author producer drowns off of Long Island. And this was Gary Baldwin. So it would be interesting to go find out if this guy was a Titanic survivor and how he really died. But that was a very interesting story.
Nice.
Weird Mystery Tales, number two.
What year was that from?
1979. Oh, no, 1972.
Sorry. Oh, okay. That's all right.
So Jack Kirby fanatics should try to look up 1, 2, and 3. I have 1 and 3 on the way because I'm a fanatic, so I will have those books soon.
Fill it in.
Yeah, but this is an interesting series. The only blurb it says right here is this series simply got lost in the mass of similar titles being published at DC at the time. So, you know, House of Mystery, House of Secrets, all the other stuff that was going on, Ghosts, it seemed to have had a lower run because it just got lost in the sheer quantity of horror books.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of stuff at that time with things that were popular that can't even sell these days.
Mm-hmm.
But well, I had one other comic, which, because we were talking last time about how, you know, I'll start talking about series on the show and then just sort of drop them and never mention them again. And so I picked up Millennium again with issue 5. The last time I talked about this was like 2 months ago. But again, this is Steve Englehart that does the story. Joe Staton does the layouts with Ian Gibson finishes. Bob Lappin letters, Carl Gafford colors, Andy Helfer editor. And the sort of framing sequence of this issue, week 5, issue 5, is the Guardian and the what are the women called? Gamorrean? Is that right?
The
Guardians.
The Gamorreans.
Yeah, Gamorreans. So they've selected all of their people that they're supposed to be from around the world, that they're supposed to be enlightening, and they've got them amassed together, including Thomas Kalamaku and the Floronic Man and the white supremacist dude from South Africa. And they've got them all together, and they're teaching them this lesson about the nature of reality and humanity and stuff. and this information that they wanna impart to them, and that kind of fits in with the cover, which has the two of them on a hilltop, and it says the teaching on it, and it's got their selected people in the foreground beneath them in the first line, and then it has a bunch of like the DC superheroes behind them. But so their whole thing, it's very the dialogue that they present, this teaching, is very metaphysical. It's kind of based on logic, but they talk about how logic demands a sequence, and we see reality as following a sequence, and they go through the numbers, and throughout the issue they'll periodically they'll talk about a number, and then we'll see what's going on with the superheroes involved in the event, and then they'll go to another number, and it kind of parallels what's going on in the story. So they start off talking about the number one, where they say, you know, one day in one spot in the midst of nothingness, something begins, a birth of existence, the Big Bang, we may call it one. And then we see Superman on his own as a number one kind of thing, where he arrives at what's already going on at the Green Lantern headquarters. And so then we have a panel where the Gamorrean is talking about two, the concept of other, and we see Superman come onto stage with Batman, and all the heroes have been have just cheered Batman as Superman arrives. And it's interesting because, you know, I don't know, I think about like now and with the new 52 and the way that things are changing for people and their superheroes and how they have complaints and things are still being established about the heroes and how and what has changed. And when this came out in 87, there was still kind of, I think it was probably the same experience for people, like maybe how people are now reading Forever Evil. I think there were probably still people reading this crossover that were reacting to the way that things had changed in the DC universe, because I think they're kind of underlining that Batman and Superman have a different relationship in this sequence, where Superman asks what's all the cheering about, and Blue Beetle in the crowd says that Batman just reported that the Manhunter's hideout's been destroyed, and Superman says, "Really? You did that?" And Batman says, "I only had a hand in it." But then in a thought bubble, he thinks, "But I can't deny that I'm glad you had none." But there's a lot of, on the one hand, I feel like they're trying to make sure that if you're not reading all the crossovers, which each week that this came out, there were a lot of books that crossovered into the event. And I do give them kudos for recapping a lot of stuff that happened in the crossover issues, so that if you were just reading this, you wouldn't have to. But the way that it's presented does result in a lot of like characters talking and telling each other stuff that happened. So there's a lot of exposition, like Captain Atom goes on to explain how he had rescued Firestorm from the control of the Manhunters. There's just a lot of recapping going on, and there's a lot of like just the heroes standing around talking. As we go up through the issue, they continue up the number counts while we're checking in with the lesson that the two of them are giving their people. The members of the Outsiders get a distress call and take off, and that makes Batman curious, so he cuts out in the middle of a conversation that he's having with Mr. Miracle, like right in the middle of Mr. Miracle's sentence, and just walks away. And while the heroes are kind of celebrating and just kind of like the progress that they've made so far against the Manhunters, some of the heroes end up going off, and they having discussions, just like lots and lots of talking. And ultimately what happens in the end is that they some of the heroes are gathering together to create a force. We think that it might just be nine, because the Gamorrean's lessons has gotten to that number, as Hawkman and Hawkgirl show up to make the number of the heroes nine. And but then Dr. Fate shows up, throwing the number up to 10. It ends with them saying, 10 is life in the long run, and the symbol for 10 is one of something and the zero of nothing, equal and unified. Life can be one whole, and that is all there is to it. And, I kind of was... I kind of felt like the issue was average. Like, there wasn't a lot of progress, and there was a lot of funky dialogue and just a lot of like standing around and talking. There wasn't much action. Like a good example of some of the more, some of the funnier dialogue, just when the Gamorrean is explaining number two. But just as two is all that one is not, so is four the reverse of three. The nature of nature is sequence, and the limitations of three cannot be the end. The very nature of nature itself demands another creation. The nature of life demands number four.
What the fuck does that mean?
I know. And if the entire everything that the Guardian and the Gamorrean say sounds like that, and I can just imagine like they're people that they're supposed to be training and turning into these super beings just sitting there like cross-eyed, like, what the fuck is going on? Like, just not understanding anything they're saying. So there's a lot of that, and then it's cut with like the superheroes just kind of hanging around and talking amongst themselves. So it's very much a treading water kind of issue. As like a millennium ultimately is like 8 weeks long, so the event itself is eight issues long, and this definitely seemed like a filler issue. But I'm gonna try to finish it out. You know, across issue. Yeah, I'm not. I left it by for a while, but I'm still like, I think I'm enjoying it more reading it now, like over 20 years later, than I would have at the time, because the 80s are probably my favorite comic book era. So because it's like the 80s version of these DC heroes, that makes it more palatable to me. I think if I was reading it at the time, I would have been frustrated with it a bit more.
You would have been on the interwebs. If there were interwebs saying, what the hell is this? DC, F you.
Yeah, I'd have been like, I would have pulled out my typewriter angrily and pounded the keys to write them an angry letter for the letter column.
Yeah.
Which there is no, I guess because it was a weekly comic, there is no letter column in the back. There's actually an interview between, it's DC interviewing Steve Englehart about his involvement in the series.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, yeah, I mean, there was this week five had crossovers in Justice League International number 10, Firestorm 68, Wonder Woman 13, Flash number 9, the new Wally West series, and Outsiders 28. So, but what is kind of interesting is that the one that did the interview and like wrote that little preview at the end there of what's coming up next week is signed Mark Waid. It's back in his editor days.
Yeah. All right. I am going to close us out then. Unless, Norbert, do you have any other books you want to mention? Or?
No, not right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us. It was nice having you on the show.
Yeah.
Thanks. Right.
Well, if you want to listen, I got two more Batman books I'm going to talk about. But I'm going to do it really fast.
That's okay. I was just going to get a pizza, but I can wait a couple more minutes.
Oh no, you could go. You could go if you're done. feel free. I'm just going to talk about two more comics, and then we're going to call it an episode.
Yeah, I'll listen to that later, of course.
Sure.
Okay, yeah. Sounds good.
Well, any contact information?
Yeah, when I'm on a podcast, you know, it's just weird, you know, when I get to listen to my own voice, you know, I don't like so much.
Yeah, I've gotten, you know, I remember back in the day when I would hear myself recorded and it wouldn't sound like me. Now I think I've heard my own voice enough that it actually, like, hearing my recorded voice and hearing myself talk right now, it sounds the same to me, but I think you have to, like, hear yourself talk a lot before that happens.
Probably.
Yeah. But, is there any contact information or anything you want to shout out before you sign off?
Same as last time.
Well, just in case they didn't listen to it.
In the general context, I'm now also helping to organize a con, like locally where I live in Germany.
That's awesome.
And at the remote chance that there are some listeners, you know, close to Nuremberg and Erlangen in Germany, later this month, you know, our con is on the 31st of May, Saturday, at the eWork Community Center, and it's called Contrast.
Nice.
Anyway, GamerCon, but we can also talk comics. I can always talk comics with me.
Yeah, that's cool. They have to let us know if anybody comes up and says that they listen to the Retrocast. Find out if we have.
And I suddenly get a drink and a T-shirt or something.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, you have a good one, Norbert. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you too. Have a good Sunday.
Enjoy your pizza. You too. What kind of pizza are you going to eat?
Probably salami with some extra spicing.
Thank goodness! I thought you were going to say something ramps. With ramps. All right. You have a good Sunday. Talk to you later.
All right. Bye, Norbert.
Bye.
Bye.
All right. The next two books that I'm going to talk about, I'm going to be quick about.
That's cool.
I got two first appearances of Batman. One of them is the Man with 10 Eyes, 15-cent cover price. It's Batman 226 from 1970, and the other one is 307 Batman from 1979. So the first story is the first appearances of the Man with 10 Eyes. Not very popular character, but he did show up in 52. If you remember him in 52, or maybe it was Countdown, he had the eyeballs on his hands. He's a very obscure character. In this case, he has kind of a tragic origin, and there's a lot of misunderstandings that turn him into a villain. But the story is by Frank Robbins. The art is by Irv Novak with Dick Giordano doing the inks. I should be able to pronounce that. He's very popular. This is a story of a bunch of crooks that are going to try to get into a vault. And they have a security guard, and that security guard is an ex-Vietnam vet. And that vet, they tried to bribe him earlier by just saying, hey, we'll give you a large sum of money if you just leave the door open so we can get in there. And he wouldn't do it. So they attack him, and they want to kill him. And it's like he takes out like seven dudes. And he says he has a third, they call him third, in Vietnam they called him a three-eyed Reardon because he had like the sixth sense of what was going on. But one of the guys hits him with a brick, knocks him out unconscious, gives him a concussion, and then they go to take the vault. They didn't kill him though, and they thought they wanted to kill him. But, while they're going to blow the vault, Batman swings in because he knows that there's dynamite attached to the vault and it's going to blow open. And the security guard is totally unconscious, comes in with his concussion. He thinks Batman is trying to break the safe. So they get into a huge fist fight, and this guy can fight pretty good. But the bomb goes off, and it kind of blinds Batman and this guy. And the other guys go and take the loot and then leave. Batman wakes up and he can't see, and he's like, "Alfred, I need help. Can you get me back to the Batcave? I can't see what's going on." The other guy gets picked up by the thieves because they were like, "This guy's a badass fighter. He was fighting Batman on his own." And they realize he's blind, and they actually take him to the doctor because they want to get his eyesight healed. The weird thing is the Batman and this guy go to the same damn doctor, which is weird. And Batman goes in his cape and cowl with Alfred. Like, I don't know why in the world he would go in his cape and cowl with Alfred. You'd think that would have some kind of identity thing, but he goes there. And Batman's eyesight is only temporary. He's like, "You're going to have to, you know, not do anything for a couple months. You're not going to be able to see." But he has Alfred put in these contact lenses where Alfred can be his eyes, which is it's kind of insane. And Whoa. He can still fight crime. Whereas this guy with 10 eyes, he's lost his eyesight temporarily, and he blames Batman. So this is a guy that was just. He wouldn't take bribes to have thieves come in and take the safe. He was a just guy. They say he believes these guys are legit, and they saved him and took him to a doctor. And they took his optic nerves and somehow connected him to his hands, his fingertips. So now he can see through his fingertips. But then it's just a battle between him and Batman. They go after each other, and he wants to blind Batman. And the way he does it is Batman goes back to the doctor, and he's like, "Hey, could you help me out? I can't see." And he's like, Batman says, "Well, that's like the blind leading the blind," because he can't see either. And as soon as Batman turns his head, he clocks him. And then he's using like lasers and stuff at the eye doctor to try to take away his eyesight, because he thinks Batman took away his. And they get into a huge fight, and Batman eventually is able to take him down by covering his hands with his bat cape and having one of his hands break, which caused him severe pain. But when he was going back to get the doctor to help him out, he was gone, and it's to be continued in the next issue. And the interesting thing about this is dated 1970, and they have a huge thing at the end of this comic that says Kirby is coming. That's sweet, huh? And then they have an awesome tale in the back. It's called The Case of the Gigantic Gamble. And this is like a crazy-ass story where you as the reader are supposed to solve the crime before it like tells you, do you know why he's guilty or why the cops are going to find you to be guilty? Look at the art carefully before you continue on to the next page. But the story opens up as these two guys meeting, and they're like outside of a hotel, and this guy's like, "Hey, I'm new to this town, and I'm bored. Is there any place I could find some gambling?" And this guy invites him up to his own house, and they end up gambling, and this guy loses his entire amount of money, and the guy's stressing out. He says, "You got to give me a chance to win my money back." And he goes, "Well, you have nothing else to gamble." And he goes, "I own this freak show." "And I will sign over the papers to my freak show right now. So we'll gamble that." And he ends up losing that. So now this other guy owns the freak show, and he's like, "I can't give up the freak show. It's the only way I make money." And he decides to kill him. So he kills this guy that he's been gambling with that's from out of town and now owns his place. And he's like, "I gotta like somehow say that he came into this. I found him here, and he was found dead, and they'll believe me." And his story goes through good, but the cop busts him right away because this guy thinks that his car windshield wipers won't have snow on it, like it's covered with snow, that he's been there a while. but he had no wiper imprints on it, so, and he got there before it snowed, so that was the key to finding out why this detective knew exactly what that he had killed this guy, and then he admits it right off the bat. But it's just a crazy-ass idea of a story. I would think that story would be in Detective rather than Batman, you know?
I was actually thinking the same thing while you were talking about it, like trying to remember if you said Detective, not Batman.
Yeah, it's Batman. It was unusual. But it was fun because I could see what they're doing is they're trying to get the kids at this time to look at the artwork and see if they could see the clues. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It was an interesting idea. The next comic I'm talking about, 307, is the first appearance of Lucius Fox.
Oh, cool.
Which is a big deal because this guy has been in almost all three Batman films. He's he's kind of a big character in the Batman. He kind of runs Wayne Tech, invents all of Batman's, a lot of his vehicles and etc. And this is his first appearance. Yeah, his son is Batwing.
Yeah.
So this is about a serial killer, which could also be a Batman villain that they could bring back, that kills homeless people. He basically gives them gold coins, and the gold coins are laced with poison. And Batman's working to try to find out who this killer is. And the scene with Lucius Fox is very interesting because they introduce him, but it's like you've always known him. Does that make sense? The way they're talking back and forth and the way things are going, it's like you as a reader should always know that this guy existed and is running the corporation.
Yeah, like it's his, the first appearance, but it's written in a way to tell you that we just haven't seen him.
Yeah, it's very cool because it's like he's been part of this organization for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the story is written by Len Wein with art by John Calhan, and Dick Giordano is the inker. And so, man, you go from a 15-cent comic to a 40-cent comic, and we have the same inker. That's pretty cool, huh?
Yeah. He was around for a long time.
Yeah. And they have the second Superman movie contest. The first prize would win the actual cape worn by Christopher Reeve in the filming of Superman the movie. The 10 second prizes, a page from the original Superman artwork. And the unlimited third prizes are subscriptions to your favorite DC Comics. Enter today. So that was a cool little thing for the Superman the movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, Commissioner Gordon and Batman have like this really working relationship back in this, where Batman could just show up at the police station and nobody thinks anything of it. Mm-hmm. But this guy comes barging in. He's like, "Hey, I saw this gold coin killer in the newspaper on the Gotham Gazette. They stole my coins. They're my coins." And he's like, "Mister, who are you?" And he's like, "You know, don't play." He's mad because they stole this whole collection. And Batman's there listening to him, and he's like, "Mr. Conroy will find out who stole your coins." And it goes on this big adventure where Batman tries to go talk to the homeless people, and he meets an underground homeless people that live underground because there's like a water, hot water that runs underneath, and it's like keeps them warm and stuff. And one's like a Shakespearean actor, one's a guy that used to play for the Gotham Giants in 48. One used to be like an actress, and they're just homeless now. But anyway, he tells them about these coins, and they're laced with poison, and he finds this killer. He's like, he's pretty good fighter because he fights Batman pretty good, but he looks like the Shadow, except he's wearing a green jacket and green pants and has a red scarf, and they fight, and he gets away, and they're trying to find out who he is, and when they pull off the scarf, he looks like an old guy. And, well, this guy is supposed to be the Mr. Connor's father, like the guy who he went homeless because he just went nuts. Like, I guess some people that are become recluses. Well, this guy became a recluse and didn't want anything to do with money and went homeless. And you think it's him but it's really the son. The son is schizophrenic, and he's acting like he's his father, and Batman takes him out. But nice. It was a cool little story.
Yeah. Nice.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I've mentioned in Twitter and stuff like that I've been pretty into Batman lately. It's like I go up and down with my Batman. You know, he's always a favorite character of mine, just like the whole Gotham and Bat family environment and stuff like that appeals to me. But sometimes I get like oversaturated with Batman and I need like to have my distance.
I take breaks, but
to spend some time
I'm
apart.
Never disappointed with a Batman comic for some reason.
Yeah.
Because I find his villains like to be the best. I find whatever I'm reading or whatever era, I'm getting something out of it, you know? So.
Yeah, and I like that there's that long history there, almost as long as Superman, but, you know, I just find him a more interesting character.
Yeah.
So, and I lucked out, because the bookstore that I talk about that I stop in a lot and browse their comics that they have for $1, sometimes they have them on sale and stuff, but I just happened to stop in just in the same, like, a few hours after they had dropped off like 9 or so short boxes of stuff. And usually when it comes to, like, I find that Batman and Spider-Man, you know, back issues are harder to find because the popularity of the characters. And they also, like, especially with like Amazing Spider-Man and stuff like that, they also have a higher collectability value and like, so more expensive and stuff. And, usually, if they have any, like Batman or Detective or Amazing Spider-Man, like those go really fast, and I hardly ever see them in there. But I happened to, like I said, I happened to get there when they had just dropped off some new, and one of the short boxes was mostly Detective Comics. So I kind of swooped up like 14 or 15 issues of Detective, and made sure I got the ones that were actually hard to find for that price.
Yeah.
You know, because some of them you can get for $1, depending on the era of Detective that you're talking about and stuff. But so I was happy to get like a little run in like the, I think it was like late 500s or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it actually had the one issue I saw that like it was selling for like $6 or $7 online, because it was it's the first appearance of Ventriloquist and Scarface.
Yeah, so that is what's fascinating is going on these trails, like especially if you have like the little ADD where I jump around a lot. One of the things I found is like I'll like read a panel in Batman Eternal, and I'm like, holy shit! Okay, there's Firefly, there's Cluemaster, there's everybody that was around the table, and I was like, do I have all their appearances? And I had all of them, but I didn't have Firefly, so I went and bought the Firefly, which is a 10-cent book of Batman. And I get on these little tangents, and then as I look through Future's End, like I'm looking at the characters, and I'm like, do I have that first appearance? And I go off on these. I just find these weeklies have me so excited. Chris, the pacing I just find is amazing, because I get that weekly dose, and that's the first thing I want to read, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, bang, I'm excited.
Yeah. I'm liking Batman Eternal. I don't have Future's End number one yet. I read the, zero issue, and I actually wasn't like, I didn't hate the zero issue. I didn't have a problem with the violence or anything like that, but it just kind of left me like kind
couldn't
of
get into
neutral.
It, yeah.
I was just kind of like, whatever. Like, it didn't really do much for me, but like, it didn't affect my interest in the series yet, because like Lemire, Azzarello, and Jurgens are like definitely three writers who are up there for me. So like, I give them a lot of benefit of the doubt, and like, I'm not gonna, like, if for some reason I read like the first four issues and I'm still kind of like meh, but I don't expect that to happen. So
yeah, and see, I loved it, man, because it was like Flash and Captain Cold and a resistance movement getting invaded by these bugs, and you find out that most of the bugs are characters that we know that have already been assimilated, and then the scene with Batman and Batman Beyond was freaking amazing, and I love that Alfred's a computer and he's, you know, he talks and has the wit of the Alfred that we know, but he's not alive.
I did like that.
Incredible.
That was probably the best part of the issue for me was Batman.
And then they have Batman Inc. Omax come in. I mean, they're the ones that invade the cave and kill Bruce. It's just amazing. I'm on for this ride, and issue one definitely did not disappoint me. I was like, wow, I can't believe all this just happened in one issue, you know?
Yeah, I should have that on Monday night. I should be reading, be able to check that out, and I'm looking forward to checking it out.
Yeah, me and CK from No Apologies talked about it for about 38 minutes or 30 minutes in a DC Noise Bites. We talked about issues 0 and 1, and so I'm plugging my other podcast. But
yeah, I'm gonna definitely check that out.
It was a lot of fun, and
that's cool.
I'm excited. Batman Eternal number 5. I don't know if you got to it yet, but it's also got some really good stuff in there.
Yeah, that I'll be reading on Monday too, because I ordered like the books that came out Wednesday from this retailer in Massachusetts, because I haven't really been pre-ordering my DC stuff.
Yeah,
like my DCBS order, I've just been doing like some Image number ones and like
stuff
trades
like
and stuff like that. That's harder to, and like I've been doing their Valiant bundle, like stuff that's a little harder to find.
Yeah,
and then the DC stuff. And like I did Amazing Spider-Man number 1 and stuff. Like there's this retailer, Chamber of Comics in Massachusetts, that he puts the books up on Comic Collector Live like Wednesday morning, and like they're almost as cheap as DCBS. So like I've just been getting them that way right now, because one, then like he ships them that day, and they usually get here Monday, so then I'm not like as far behind on what's going on with the DC stuff.
Yeah.
And I also can like decide if like it, like if I don't like a book, then I don't have like 2 or 3 issues of it coming still.
Yeah.
And with DC stuff, that might happen to me. Like, whereas with like the indie, like with Image stuff, like I'm probably going to read like a trade's worth of issues before I decide anyways, if I don't just get it. Like the stuff that I was already getting in trade, I'm still getting in trade. And then if like new number ones come out that I think, like because of the creative team,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure I'm gonna like it. Like I've been ordering every issue of Southern Bastards because I love Jason Aaron's writing.
You did read that?
I haven't gotten it yet.
That's funny. Funny you mentioned it. You always mention stuff that has links. It's like we're on the same page. But I just read that right before we started podcasting.
Oh, that's funny.
So this has been Geek Brunch Retrocast episode
32, I believe.
32.
Like I said, yeah.
And we thank Norbert for coming on. He has a good history with like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon and sci-fi properties like that, cuz he really likes that. And thank him for coming on and talking Buck. That episode was good. I was really happy with that episode.
Yeah, it was enjoyable.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Seeing Mr. Hand. And you can reach us at MythMakingETC or at Mike Myers Brunch. We should make a Retrocast Twitter account, I think.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. And maybe
old comic pictures and stuff.
Yeah. You can go to Facebook and search for Geek Brunch Podcast and look us up there. You know, we have several people that comment on the episode threads, and we appreciate that. David is one of them. Mm-hmm. I'm glad he's enjoying the Buck Rogers stuff. Is we're enjoying it too. And what else do we got? We got emails at mike@comicbooknoise.com. And what is your email?
MythMakingETC@gmail.com.
There you go. Could see I never send him email.
Yeah. No, we communicate in Facebook pretty much. Yeah. So, I may be putting MythMakingETC, the podcast, like on hiatus for a while. I think rather than try to keep to a schedule, I think what I'm going to do, like over the summer, for those who don't know, like I'm getting married beginning of September. So as things kind of ramp up with planning for that and stuff, I think what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to work on the side when I have the time on like a more like researched project with comics. Mm-hmm. That then I'll like record, and I'll probably get like ahead and like release those later, like in the fall and stuff. But I'd like to, instead of just doing like kind of an off the cuff summary that's similar to what we do here, I think of issues and stuff, I'm looking into maybe doing more of like a researched history of like of a comic series, where I read some interviews and things like that about the series, and put some notes together before recording, and just kind of approach it that way.
Yeah, that would be very interesting.
So we'll see. That may be coming, like, I think, but I think I'll take my time with it and make sure I have like a few prepared ahead of time and just do it when I can. And then like this fall, it might be easier for me to keep to a schedule with something. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. That may become in the future.
And for me, you could find me on Geek Brunch, as well as this cast, and DC Noise, DC Noise Bites, and other things. Oh, the Valiant podcast. So I do a lot of podcasting. So
yes, you do.
Yeah. I like to talk about comics as much as I like to read them.
I mean, it's definitely part of the fandom, and like you figure you get more out of your money that you're spending on them that way too, you know?
Right. Like, even with the weekly ones, I'm finding out more and more every time I read them, you know, as I delve into them. But
yeah, if you're going to talk about them, it makes you like pay a little more attention to what you're reading. You know, you have to, and then you kind of catch some subtleties that you might not have if you just read it once and moved on to the next thing, you know?
Right.
So it can be cool. Yeah, and I mean, because like a lot of times when I read an issue, if I'm like, if I get to the end, I'm like, holy shit, that was amazing. Like, one of the first things I do, like, is to just go, like, check out what people are talking about on the internet about it, you know? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, like, people in forums shitting on it, but, like, reviews at, like, decent websites, or, like, what friends have said about it, you know?
Yeah.
Or, like, ask for a reaction from other people who read it and stuff, from friends. Because it's nice to just have that, like, community and share that kind of hear what other people think.
Let me know what you think of Southern Bastards when you're done.
Yeah, I will. Yeah. It'll be probably at the end of the month, because that the DC, I just do the monthly on the
monthly
DC
shipment,
stuff,
yeah,
DCBS stuff. So
yeah,
but yeah, with stuff like that, it's like I feel like Image stuff tends to read like it tends to take like a few more issues to get a sense of where they're going. So even if I get the single issues, like I'm usually probably going to give it like 4 or 5 issues, like, or like the first storyline, to see where they're going. Cause sometimes they're trying something really different, and you know, you might take a little while to get a sense of what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
Read that like first trade equivalent kind of thing.
But yeah, I like the historical thing too. So I'll be interested to see what you do with that. Like, let me know when you start to release that, because I would love to do that, but I can never do that and then keep up with the amount of material, or try to keep up, I shouldn't say keep up, the amount of material that I'm intaking. I'm pretty much a fire hose, and
Well, and also the amount of podcasting too. Like, I realize that right now, other than like doing the retrocast is a part of my schedule. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's integrated into, you know, Kara knows that like every other Sunday it's something I do, and like right now, making other commitments as far as my hobbies go and stuff like that, it's probably not the best time.
Yeah.
You know, so I figure with this, it's like when I do find the time, that I might otherwise be doing like a different podcast or something like that, like I can just, it's just me. So I can work on it whenever I get a chance and take some notes or do some reading and stuff. And then like maybe that'll have me like ahead of the game if I do start releasing them in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So just like build up a little backlog before I.
Yeah, it's start. Like if you were doing an Image comic, you want to get the work done before you start releasing them.
Yeah, exactly.
Except like, you're not making any money.
I'm not gonna put out. Yeah, I'm not gonna solicit. I'm not gonna do a specific. This is just a tease. I won't put out like the solicitation for episode one until I've got like a few in the can, like
there you
like
go,
a test or something.
Yeah.
But yeah.
All right. So, well, you have a good Sunday. It's actually snowing over here. Can you believe that? It's freaking May 11th, and it's snowing right now.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Makes me like feel good for living in Buffalo for once. I think we're done with the snow. Somebody's cutting their grass out there.
Right.
So, all right.
Well, you have a good one. Yep, talk you to too. You later. Bye.
Right. Bye.
Set free by the teen angels from his prehistoric block of glacier ice comes the world's first superhero, Captain Caveman. Now the constant companion to the teen angels, Brenda, Dee Dee, and Taffy, in their hilarious and sometimes scary mystery mission. Get ready for Captain.